All right, we are now recording. We are not in music mode. I believe I now have the recordings of the class up to date. That is that I've webbed all of the recordings I've got for this class and the other. So if you missed a class and want to go over it, or if there's something you feel like revising, or if you want to tell a friend in Timbuktu how interesting our classes are and point him at it on the web, you're now free to do that. I wanted to start by talking a little and getting your comments on the controversy over the sources of Islamic law, because you've now read the chapter in Forte's book in which he sums up the conventional view and then Schacht's view, the modern Orientalist critique of the conventional view. And I've just put on reserve a long email from somebody on the anti-Schacht side who is arguing that indeed the traditional view is correct and the Schacht's critique is wrong. And I'm going to add that to the syllabus when I get home tonight, because I think it's actually quite interesting. The person who wrote that is, I think, currently faculty at Stanford. I say I think because what I have is an email that somebody passed on to me, and the name on the email isn't quite identical to the name on the faculty at Stanford, but it's almost the same, and names that are originally in foreign languages get transliterated different ways, and since the guy at Stanford is indeed a student of the early history of Islamic law, I think the odds are pretty good that he's the right person. And I'm going to try to email him and see if I can persuade him to give us a guest lecture at some point, because it would be fun to have an insider talk to us about this. In any case, the traditional view of where Sharia comes from starts with the Quran, and the Quran, at least by Forte's count, has about 240 legal rules in it, which would sound like a lot to somebody who wasn't at law school, but sounds like a tiny number to somebody who is at law school. And then the next source is what is referred to as the Sunnah of the Prophet, meaning the practices of the Prophet. How did Muhammad, when he was alive, actually do, act, and what did he say? And what did he tacitly assent to? Because Muhammad was, you know, divinely inspired and all of that, so his behavior gives us a model of what we should do. And if you look at the actual hadith, it goes into details such as how long should your underpants be? Not down to the ankle, but below the knee, if I remember correctly, and what do you get buried in, and all sorts of other stuff like that. And by about 130 AH, that is after the Hijra. The Hijra, remember, is when Muhammad flees from Mecca to Medina, and it's the beginning of the Muslim dating system, a little before 600 AD, if you want to put it into our terms. About 130 AH, you've got a book with about 600 traditions in it. By the end of the second Islamic century, that is by 200 AH, you've got one compilation with 50,000 traditions in it. So there's enormous numbers of them. And it's pretty clear that one of the things that's going on during this period is that someone interested in the law meets somebody who might have known people who knew the Prophet and says, do you know any traditions? Are there any traditions you can recite for me that you can tell me? And that's been going on for a long time and thereafter. And then they collect traditions, and some of them write them down in these collections. In general, a tradition includes something called an isnad, which is the chain of transmission for that tradition. That is to say, the tradition is in the form of, on the following occasion, the Prophet did such and such, this tradition is told to us by so and so, who told it to so and so, who told it to so and so, who told it to so and so. That's the chain of transmission. Somewhere in Muhammad's people, there's this story of some religious scholar who was caught drinking wine. And they ask him, you know, why is he violating the law by drinking wine? And he says, well, I bought this wine from a Christian who bought it from a Jew. I was only willing to drink it because its chain of transmission was so weak. You wouldn't cross the tradition that you got from a Christian from a Jew, would you? After all, so it obviously isn't really illegal wine, after all. Anyway, so from the standpoint of, from the Islamic standpoint, the authentication of traditions, figuring out which ones are real, is basically not a religious issue, but secular scholarship. That's a matter of human reason to say, here is the reason to believe that this text really describes what Muhammad did 300 years ago, and this one doesn't. And that's been a project into which Islamic scholars have poured huge amounts of time and energy over the centuries. And by the 3rd century, you have what are still considered the authoritative collections of traditions. Now in the thousands, not in the tens of thousands, but basically you've got scholars who supposedly went through, I think, a good deal more than 50,000, but a very, very large number of traditions, trying to figure out which ones were genuine, throwing out the ones they thought were probably not genuine, and then ending up with a few thousand that they were pretty sure really described what Muhammad and his companions had said and done. And those then become the second source after the Quran. Notice that the Sunnah is the practice of the Prophet. The Hadith are traditions about the practice of the Prophet. So you get the terms used almost interchangeably. Sunnah, I think, is where we get the term Sunni for one of the two major schools of Islam. The Hadith is, as it were, the evidence of what the Sunnah was. During this period, in addition to these sources, we don't have enough traditions, or at least enough reasonably reliable traditions, plus Quranic rules to answer anything like all legal questions. So you had people engage in independent reasoning, in arguing from analogy, sort of like the Chinese were, that is filling in the gaps by saying, well, this is sort of like that, we've got a tradition for that, so that tells us how to deal with this. And finally, by ijma, which is consensus. And where consensus is coming from is that it was claimed that there was a tradition by which the Prophet had said, my people will never be agreed upon an error. And that was taken to mean that if in some sense everybody who mattered agreed about some legal point, then that legal point must be right. Who everybody who matters is not clear. And I think different people had different interpretations as to whether that ultimately meant all Muslims or all Muslim legal scholars or the prevalent view of all schools of Muslim law, but in some sense the theory was that at some point each issue got closed off once consensus was reached. By about the 10th century AD, the view of most of the legal scholars was that consensus had been reached on everything that mattered. And that's what's referred to as the closing of the gates, that the view, at least as held by many, almost anything that I say about Islamic history, someone who knows more than I do can disagree with, but it appears to be at least some more or less a consensus view that from then on, what legal scholars were supposed to be doing was not figuring out the law, but studying the work of the legal scholars up to about 1000 AD, up to about the 10th century, AD, which would be whatever, let's see, I guess about the 4th century, roughly AH, and that therefore was the legal job of the legal scholars to know what the great scholars of the past had said, not to figure it out for themselves. And this process ended up with 4 mutually orthodox schools of law, all 4 of which had developed in, I think, about the first 150 years after Muhammad's, after the Hijra, in, to some extent, in different of the major cities of Islam where scholarship was going on. Each school is associated with a person, with a scholar who was sort of the founder of that school, and they agree in general but disagree on details, as you know if you've looked through that part of the book already. And the theory was that what the Qadi, the judge, was doing was simply applying this law that had already been determined without himself innovating. So that the way I like to describe it is that Sharia is what the common law would be like if law professors ran the world. Because the way the common law actually is, the binding precedents are by judges, whereas in Sharia, the equivalent of binding precedents is by the equivalent of law professors, that is, by legal scholars who need not be judges, who will have given their results not as the verdict in a case, but as essentially a treatise arguing that such and such a legal rule follows from the original sources. So you have, as I said, what was referred to as the closing of the gates of ijtihad, the closing of the gates of legal reasoning, by the end of our 10th century, in favor of following what had already been established. And this is worth noting because if you think about the present state of Islam, there are a number of ways you could imagine it going. It's clear that there are sort of serious problems in applying traditional Islamic law and institutions in the modern world. Maybe those problems are soluble. Presumably there are some Muslims who would say, well, we had it right then, same rules apply. What actually happened in the 20th century, maybe beginning in the 19th, was a modernization in which in various Muslim countries, they essentially imported Western law, and to varying degrees did or didn't displace or supplement Sharia with that. That's a second possibility. Say Sharia was fine for a long time, we need something new. But the most interesting possibility from my standpoint is that you reopen the gates. That people say, look, indeed the Quran is a holy document, we've got to believe it. Indeed, whatever the real authentic traditions of the Prophet are, those are evidence of what the divinely inspired founder of the religion said. But all this interpretation beyond that, that was a human project, we can redo it, and we can now create, as it were, a modern, up-to-date version of Sharia on the same foundations with a new version. And that's an interesting possibility, and there are clearly people who would like to do it, whether it will happen. I don't know. You sort of think,
you don't think that's happening now anyway?
I don't know. I just don't know enough. But I don't think that's at least the accepted view of matters. But it's sort of interesting because this is one of the few cases where what we're studying in the seminar sort of intersects with the modern world around us that's affecting us, because there are whatever, I don't know what the current number is, I suppose a billion or so Muslims nowadays, and we're interacting with them, we're worrying about the Iranians getting an atomic bomb, we're worrying about what's happening in Iraq and lots of other places, Afghanistan, so we are, in some sense, interacting with the world of 1,000 years ago, only it's still here. It's represented by real human beings, some of whom are presumably intelligent, thoughtful people, and so forth. So that what I've given is now the traditional version. Schacht and several other Orientalists, that is basically Western scholars of Islamic history, argue that was all bogus. Their view was that what really happened was that the laws being enforced under Muhammad were basically the pre-existing Arabic legal system from before that, modified somewhat because Muhammad made changes in some specific issues such as marriage law and some other things from more or less religious grounds. That in the conquered provinces, as Islam spread outside of Arabia, you had legal rules based on local custom, and as the Umayyads, who were the first dynasty, remember the basic history is Muhammad run things for not very long, I was just checking the dates, and Muhammad dies about 10 years after the Hijrah. I hadn't realized it was that short, and some of that time is spent converting people in Medina, fighting a war with Mecca in order to get Mecca, fighting the Jewish tribes in Medina, and so forth. So I don't know, I really ought to look at the history more carefully. My guess is that the period in which Muhammad is actually the ruler of, as it were, an Islamic state is probably like 3 years or 4 years, a fairly short period. Yep.
Yeah, after Muhammad conquered Medina, they spread so quickly through northern Africa.
Conquered Mecca.
Yeah, went back. Was it Medina before it became Mecca?
No. Mecca is where he starts.
Right.
He then makes himself sufficiently unpopular in Mecca so that he flees to Medina.
Right. Oh,
he managed in Medina, he's got a bunch of converts already. Right. For whatever reason, there's no strong hostility against him, and eventually, more or less, everybody in Medina except the Jews is a Muslim. Based on Medina, he fights a series of conflicts with the Meccans, and eventually there's an agreement in which he basically gets Mecca.
And that's where he takes down the whole area where he puts up the rock, right?
Well, the rock was there already. That's the Kaaba.
Right.
What he does is to take down the pagan
thing,
pagan altars associated with it. Yeah.
But I guess my thought is with that, they conquer really fast and stretch really far.
But most of that is after Muhammad is dead.
Right.
Yeah, that's right.
But I mean, there's lots of laws and traditions all the way across northern Africa.
That's right.
That were very not even Arabic.
Yeah, so before you get to, of course, North Africa is basically Berber, not Arabic. Berber, and they've been Roman, of course.
Right.
But even before you get North Africa, there's Syria, Iraq, and Egypt.
Right.
Those are big areas which were under some combination of Byzantine and Sassanid rule, which were other big empires. So presumably, at least Schock's version is, they're then adopting the existing rules, and the Umayyads are imposing their own regulations and so forth.
And later, all the way to the Indus River into India.
Yeah, that's quite a lot later, though. And both that and getting into Spain. That's what we're really interested in the very early period at this point. So then in his view, as the schools of law form, they're initially just taking what the laws they observe around them, sort of organizing it, making it into a formal legal system. And then they start getting into arguments with each other, with other people, and so forth. And at that point, both sides of the argument start fabricating hadith. That people who are criticizing the legal schools, partly from a religious basis, say, well, look, you know, Muhammad's companion so-and-so said so-and-so, so you're wrong, and then the religious schools play the same game. This is Schock's version. I'm not claiming whether it's true or not. And eventually, since obviously the best authority of all was Muhammad himself, both sides push their traditions back until they're claiming to have gotten them ultimately from Muhammad. And by the end of the Umayyad dynasty, the Umayyads last for about a century, and by the end of the Umayyad dynasty, in Schock's version, the process is more or less complete. The fourth of the four schools has been established and gotten its doctrines, and the gates of interpretation close. And Schock's evidence for this is first that if you look at the very early writings, they don't seem to mention the traditions. Second, that if you look at the early doctrines of the schools, they are going to the companions and to the jurists, not to Muhammad. And third, that there are examples in the surviving literature of legal decisions made in the very early period, which are inconsistent with what were later believed to be authentic traditions. And since if the traditions really go back as far as they are claimed to, the people who made the decisions 30 years after Muhammad died would have been companions of the Prophet or known companions of the Prophet. They would have known that the Prophet did X, Y, and Z, so they wouldn't have refused to do X, Y, and Z. Now, again, I'm getting this only secondhand. I haven't actually read Schock myself. And one of the lessons that I want you to carry away from this experience, especially after you read that email I put on reserve, is never believe anybody when you've only heard one side of the argument. Because you finish reading Forte's chapter and it's perfectly clear that Schock has demonstrated that this whole structure is built on a fabrication, that the hadith are all basically bogus, and we don't really know much about the initial practice. And if you believe Forte, the traditional scholars either agree or sort of try to hand wave it away without any arguments. The email, who's from a modern person who's supporting the traditional position, offers what on the face of it look like very convincing arguments showing that Schock's completely wrong. As you'll see, it basically offers several lines of evidence, all of which it claims support the idea that most of the traditions really date from the first century. One of them is, remember that each tradition comes with a pedigree, as it were. Each tradition comes with an isnad. Which says Muhammad was seen to do this or heard to say that by Abu Bakr. I don't think he's actually a source, but he could be. And we know this because Abu Bakr mentioned it to Zubair. And we know that because Zubair mentioned it to da 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 da. And furthermore, not only did Zubair mention it to this person we'll call A, Zubair also apparently mentioned it to B and C, and then we've got further traditions on them. So that's basically what an isnad is. And of course, it might fork earlier. You might have several people who saw Muhammad do or say that. And the claim that's made, let's say, in this email, which is really sort of about an 11-page essay discussing the subject, don't know if it was ever published or not. I couldn't find it on the web, which is why I printed it out for you. Somebody sent it to me when I was asking about this a few years ago. It's been sitting on my hard drive, and it's quite interesting. The first question you can ask is the isnad of is the pattern of the isnads of traditions consistent with the pattern of the contents of the tradition? So suppose by the time we get this to Z over here, and Y and X, who we will assume are some of the fifth generation transmitters, the tradition is not going to be identical, right? You know, this is oral tradition. For a while, eventually it gets written down. So you would expect that this person would say that Muhammad did this on a Wednesday, and this person said it on a Tuesday, and this person would say there were three people who were involved in this case, and this one four, and so forth and so on. Then you'll have disagreements about the details. The claim that's made is that you judge how close... Here, let me do it this way. Let's suppose that there was another person coming off of Abu Bakr, who I'm going to call Aleph for no good reason, and then we get a guy changed from him. And the claim is that if you look at how close the contents are and compare it to how close the genealogy is, that they match. That basically, if C and E both claim to have gotten it from Zubair, they are more likely to have details the same than C and Alpha, where you got it here. Because Zubair might have misheard something from Abu Bakr, and that would have gotten transmitted to both of them. So the claim is that if you just look at what ought on the fabrication theory, on Shaq's theory, it ought to be independent, but at least this guy claims that if you look at lots and lots of them, that consistently the ones that are that ought to be most similar by the train of transmission, the ones where the separation among transmitters happened most recently, are also the ones that are most nearly agreed. Yeah.
I'm surprised this stuff wasn't written down, considering
it eventually was.
Down his stuff.
I don't think Muhammad was writing down his stuff. I think the Quran gets written. Basically, when Muhammad dies, there are lots of people who have remembered parts of the Quran. Yeah.
I think when he got his when he heard God ordained he will come to him on the mountain, he would then come down and dictate to his scribe.
Huh. Maybe I should check on that. Because my understanding was that there was some disagreement about what the authentic version of the Quran was, and that different people had different fragments of it, either in their memory or that they had written down.
That was part of the miracle, was that he was supposedly illiterate, so when he wrote it all down...
All right, I will have to check that. As I had thought that it was oral at that stage.
But it's 600 AD, so it was definitely writing.
Oh, writing obviously existed, sure. But if you look, the Icelandic stuff is in the 9th century, and nonetheless, their legal code is oral until, I think, the 12th century. So the fact that writing exists doesn't mean that everybody's actually routinely using it. Yeah?
I don't think I understand this.
All right.
Drawing.
Sure. We have a tradition which Z tells us.
Right.
And there are two things that go with that tradition. One of them is actual content. Under the following circumstances, the prophet decided this law case in this way.
Okay.
The other thing that goes with it is the pedigree. How does Z know this? Z was told it by someone who was told it by Z, who was told it by him by Zubair, who was told it by Abu Bakr, who saw the event. We then have. Let me put in X here. We have another version of this from X. X similarly tells us an account of facts. And he gives an isnad. He gives a genealogy. And he says, well, I got it from C. Who got it from Zubair? Who got it from Abu Bakr? Who saw the events? If that's what really happened, if the isnad correctly described the sequence, you would expect X and Z to have very similar versions.
Because they both got it from C.
That's right. Whereas Y might well differ a bit more than they did. There might be details added or lost because A and C might have differently remembered what Zubair told them. Somebody down this chain might be even more different because Zubair might differently remember than Alpha what Abu Bakr told them. So the claim that's being made is that you actually analyze it that way. The closeness of fit of the contents of the tradition fits the closest to fit of the genealogy. And furthermore, he makes a further and stronger claim, which is that if you try to reconstruct the genealogy from the text instead of from the isnad, if you say this is a project which people studying the New Testament have engaged in great length, and pretty clearly this is applying their techniques to a different field, where you say, well, here we've got a bunch of different things, we've got the different gospels. How do we figure out who got what from whom? They've got some things in common. Well, you can see in principle how you would do it. You would say, well, take this particular feature, which is in one source. It's in this, this, and not that. So that suggests that these two might be derived from this, or maybe this from these. You don't know which the derivation is. But if you have a number of such features, You can do the kind of thing I'm describing, but instead of just looking at closeness of fit, you can say it looks as though the branch occurred here, all right, between these diamonds. The claim is, that's what's referred to, the guy who wrote this thing refers to as thematic analysis. And his claim is that if you do that, the pattern that comes from that analysis tends to be close to the pattern in the Isnad. So that the claim is that the internal evidence of the text of the different traditions is consistent with the isnad that those traditions have with Hephaestus.
Or claim to.
That's right. But if you think about, remember when if I'm inventing it, I invent a tradition and an isnad. And nobody doubts that that happens. Because for one thing, they're legally useful. The question is whether, the real question is, well, the two questions are a substantial number of traditions genuine, and have the scholars who are usually thought of as the ones who filtered out the genuine mostly done it right? And he's arguing yes to both of those, and Chuck is arguing no. And so I invent a tradition. I invent an isnad. I don't know all the other traditions that are out there that claim to join mine somewhere back there. All right? So, or all the other traditions are somewhat similar, or I invent a varying tradition. So I'm not going to be able to fabricate my isnad well enough to do what he claims is the pattern that you're observing.
So if the different traditions that are seemingly unrelated on their face end up being traced back effectively to the same sort of isnad, then you can verify that it's actually accurate.
You have evidence that it is. You have evidence that it is. Right? His third one, which is also sort of interesting, is geographic. And his argument is that we know that the schools of law developed in several of the major cities of Islam in the early period. And if you analyze the body of traditions associated with each of four different cities, it is clear that they are different bodies of traditions, not that they don't overlap, but that certain traditions are typical of Kufa, certain of Mecca, certain of Medina, and I forget what the fourth city is. Now he says, there are some traditions where if you believe the isnad, they start out with somebody in Mecca, and then at some point are transmitted to somebody in Medina. And there are some which go the other way. Do the traditions that claim to start in Mecca and get transmitted to Medina look more like Meccan traditions or Medinan traditions? We've got the whole body of Meccan traditions, the whole body of Medinan traditions. They differ in various ways. Can we tell by content, textual analysis, whatever, whether a particular tradition looks like a Meccan or Medinan tradition? His claim is that almost always a tradition which claims to have originated in Mecca and been transmitted to Medina looks like a Meccan tradition, and the other way as well. So if that's right, then that suggests that the traditions actually originated where they said they did, and that therefore the isnad can be trusted at least back to the point at which it moved from one city to the other. So these are, it's interesting as sort of the application. Part of what's fun about it in a sense is you've got modern scholars who are in a certain sense duplicating and amplifying the work of the scholars of 1,000 years ago. Because that was a major scholarly project for a long time with lots of intelligent people who were trying to do. And he claims at least that some of the techniques he's using they didn't know. I think that they did not know the somatic approach of trying to actually reconstruct the isnad from the contents of the thing. But his claim at least supports it. So, as I say, if you only read the chapter in Forte, you say Schacht is obviously right. If you only read this text, you say Schacht is obviously wrong. And what I would like to do, and maybe someday we'll do, is see if I can find somebody in the Orientalist camp who has got rebuttals to this set of arguments. All of this goes back when I was looking at colleges a very, very long time ago. I visited Yale. Did I tell you this story? I don't think I know this story. I visited Yale, and Yale was having a program on the House Un-American Activities Committee. I don't know how many of you are familiar with political controversies of about the late 40s, roughly, is when it started out as.
McCarthy, right?
McCarthy was actually the senator. So HUAC was doing the same sort of thing, but it was the House version. Nixon was associated with that. And it was a committee which like the Senate committee under McCarthy, was engaged in investigating basically communist influence in America. And according to who you believe even today, either it was all a bogus witch hunt, or no, there really were influential Americans who in fact were members of the Communist Party or closely associated with it, and who were using their position to do bad things, as it were. But the interesting thing was that that this program included a movie called Operation Abolition, which was a movie about the campaign against HUAC, the campaign to abolish the committee. And you see that movie, and it's clear from that movie that the campaign to abolish HUAC was a communist plot. They tell you who the communists are. You can see them on the movie. HUAC was obviously a good patriotic activity, and the wicked communists were trying to suppress it, as they naturally would, of course, want to do. Then there was a second movie done by people on the other side, and it was called something like Operation Fraud, but that's not quite right. It was something, and it was basically a debunking of the first movie. And after you saw that, it was clear the first movie was bogus, that they had deliberately left out the facts that contradicted their view, and put in, I don't remember all the details, this was whatever, 50 years ago, roughly. And then they only had two movies, but both sides had pamphlets, had literature. And you could see the pamphlets from the pro-HUAC people debunking the movie, debunking the anti-HUAC movie, and I think I remember if there was a second layer on top of that. But it was a very interesting intellectual experience, because at each step in this process, you say, obviously the last guy I listened to is right. He's convincingly shown that the other people are wrong. And then you read another step in an eclipse, and I think that's a worthwhile thing, because in my experience, at least, people are much too easily convinced by hearing one side of a story. Yep.
Isn't a recent parallel to that the Da Vinci Code?
I don't know. Are there any people who take Da Vinci Code seriously?
Well, I think it would. Yeah. Well, certainly people on the other side who have written a lot of books debunking what they
that I'm sure.
So if nobody took it serious, why would they put all the effort?
Oh, sorry. I'm sure there are people who read the novel who took it seriously. The question is, are there any people who, looking at it in a serious scholarly fashion, did it? But you could also think, if you watch sort of the global warming debates, you see a very similar kind of pattern where somebody can argue that very large parts of the global warming consensus are nonsense. Someone can debunk that, someone can re-debunk that, and so forth. So that would probably be a bigger, as it were, modern equivalent of it. But I'm sure there are lots of other...
That's a huge principle just in the adversarial legal system, right? You write your brief and you turn it in and it presents your argument.
But what this is saying is that the jury shouldn't believe you. That the jury should say, well, this is an argument on this side, but we need to hear the other argument. Yeah, no, I agree that in a sense part of the theory of the adversarial system is exactly that you can't trust a single presentation of the evidence. You need people who have some incentive to present it in opposite directions. But anyway, it just seems to me, but it struck me this was quite an interesting example of that, because I found, you know, the pro-shock story convincing until I read the other one, and now I've found the other one convincing, and I'm still waiting to find somebody on the other side. But anyway, all right. So that's basically the status of that thing. So we have this existing legal system, we have a traditional account of that existing legal system, and we have some people who argue that traditional account is wrong, and people argue it's right. And I think, without knowing much more than we do, that's about as far as we can take it at this point. So let me stop just for a minute before going on to other things in my notes and see, of the stuff you've read, what things interested you that you wanted to talk about. I've been talking too long. Yeah.
One thing struck me immediately in that interview is the similarity of this system to the Chinese system, where crimes are organized by the type of punishment that fits them rather than punishments being organized by the type of crime that's committed.
Yes. The one sense, which is in a sense a difference, is that the organization by punishment is a way in which you're sorting different parts of the law rather than simply a mapping to say this crime has this punishment. And in fact, sizable chunks of the law, what the kind of punishment is discretionary. That is, sizable chunks of the law are the ones where what the law says is the judge gets to decide the punishment, unlike the Chinese case, which practically never does that.
Always.
And but what's true is that you can, one way of putting it at least, is that you can sort it in the way you're describing it. But a different way of putting it is that you've got several essentially independent sources of law, and each of them leads to certain sets of punishments, certain rules of witness, variety of other things of that sort. And it's pretty clear, I think, if you go through it, that one of the things going on is pre-Islamic Arabic law coming out of a feud system, and it's then being modified but not eliminated by the existing system. So that, for example, if I understand the situation correctly, if I am assaulted, nobody but I can charge the person with the assault. assaulting me, at least under that branch of the law, maybe under some other branch they can, but under the branch that normally covers things like assault, it's in that respect like a tort, not like a crime, that the victim is the one who has the claim. And the victim, depending on the details, may be able, if he wins his case, to claim retaliation, to claim, you know, you broke my arm, so I get to break your arm, essentially, eye for an eye, which is not taken literally in Jewish law, at least for a long time, but seems at this point taken literally. Under others, he may have the option of taking money payment instead, just like the wergeld in the Icelandic one. Sometimes it's not an option, sometimes he has to take it. So that sort of was, struck me at least as interesting as seeing the remnants of one system incorporated into another. Other points that struck you about?
On that same note, yep. The idea of the retaliation and the system, one of the other structures, the thing about the losing sight is something that could be retaliated against, but losing an eyeball is not.
Yes, you couldn't precisely enough remove an eyeball, I guess.
Yeah, so that way you only could receive some kind of money or
yes. Yes. One of the other things I thought was interesting, and that is crazy in one sense and very sensible in another, is in deciding on the amount of monetary punishment, how do you have a general rule? And the general rule is all of you is worth 300 camels or whatever it is. So half of you is worth 150 camels. Well, you have two arms. So if you are crippled in one arm, what he did, he owes you 150 camels. Well, in a certain sense, it makes no sense. Oh, I got two arms, but I also got two legs and a head, right? And yet it gives you a nice, simple rule. Well, a finger, 10 fingers, that answers that question, a tenth of 300 camels. I think it's 300 camels. I may not be getting exactly right. You have, I don't know, whatever, but it's sort of a neat case where it's clearly going to give you the wrong answer in some cases. For example, presumably losing a hand and losing the whole arm are going to be the same price because you've got two in each case. And then I suppose if they are literally losing an ear would be the same price as losing all of a leg, although it seems like a much less serious defense. But it does have the virtue that you can write down a single rule and then apply it to a large number of cases. And one of the things you would like in a legal system is it would be determinate, that it would be clear what the answers are, because otherwise people are going to spend lots of resources trying to make the punishment more or less depending on the case. Other things? Yeah. Yes. Yes, that is to say that there are some cases where it's not serious enough so that we will actually make you pay a fine or beat you or anything, but you are expected to do something which imposes the cost on yourself as a sign that you basically regret your...
Like freeing
a Muslim slave. Or like, in effect, doing the equivalent of the Ramadan fast for a month other than Ramadan. As the Ramadan fast, if I remember correctly, is that you are not supposed to eat, drink, or I think have sex during daylight. That's the form of it. Which drink sounds like the hardest part, actually, if you think about it. If I understand it correctly, one of the possible acts of penance, as it were. And of course, the Christian church has the same thing. As the Christian church had in various cases, you confess a sin and then are given a penance. Yeah? I think the answer is that it could be either. I think the answer, if I remember correctly, what Forte says, is it usually was something that we were not forced to do, but were expected to do, but sometimes it was mandatory.
So also kind of like a social expectation?
Yeah, I think so. In a way, in an odd way, it's reminding me about something in the Cheyenne, which we're not covering this year, which is that you get these, there's a weird scene in Cheyenne law. Basically, one of the rules that was enforced by the Cheyenne was that the buffalo hunt in the summer was a joint enterprise and that nobody should attack the buffalo until the signal was given for everybody to attack the buffalo. And it's a little unclear whether this was really functional because they were afraid of spooking the herd and thus being less successful in the hunt or whatever. But it's clear that one of the things that sort of wild teenagers did was to break that rule to show they could get away with breaking that rule. And you've got a case where the people who are in charge of enforcing the rules see, I think, two boys, I think it's private boys, I suspect they're probably not what we would think of as boys, who are hunting buffalo. And the enforcers ride down on them like thunder, and the transgressors show that they understand their obligations by not trying to resist or run away, at which point the enforcers kill the horses of the two boys, smash their guns, and I think tear up their blankets or something, basically destroy their property. Boys do nothing to try to stop them. They don't protest. They clearly recognize that they're the guilty party. This is only what they deserve. At which point, one of the transgressors says, look, here are these two boys out on the plains without any horses. What are we going to do about it? And one of the other enforcers says, well, you know, I've got an extra horse. I could give one of them. And I said, well, I've got an extra horse, too. I can give one of them an extra horse, too. And by the time it's finished, the enforcers have essentially replaced all the stuff they destroyed for the boys. And I think it's pretty clear that what's really going on is that the boys, by their response, are showing that they accept the validity, as it were, of the rule they broke and are being punished for breaking that rule. And once they've shown that, then it's not necessary to really punish them. It's quite a weird scene in one sense, and yet it's sort of a human feeling scene in a different sense. And there are other things like that. So yeah, I think that may well be part of what's going on. And if you go back to the comment I made some time ago about swearing oaths in the Jewish case, it might be that one consequence of you're not doing the penance is that people would say, well, you know, he may claim to be a good Muslim, but he obviously isn't a good Muslim. The Qadi told him what he was supposed to do and he didn't do it, so therefore I shouldn't trust his promises, I should be a little careful about lending him money, I should think of him as sort of the way you would think of somebody who you knew had cheated people or was a con man or something like that. So that certainly is one of the ways in which rules get enforced. Other? Yep.
There's a part that talks about unlawful enforcers, yep, saying someone was guilty of a lawful enforcers. I was kind of confused. It said if a party slanders a free, adult, competent Muslim and not previously convicted party of unlawful enforcers,
yes,
then they will be punished.
Yes.
So if the victim is not all of those characteristics,
then the other person will not be guilty, if I understand it, of the hard offense,
yeah,
of slandering vis-a-vis this. That doesn't necessarily mean that he won't be guilty of violating some other rule under one of the sort of lower level legal systems. That's one of the points that Forty makes, is that in lots of cases the hard rule only applies if you meet its conditions. That doesn't mean what you've done is legal. It may or may not be.
Yeah. So then it says
40, yes, that's an interesting pattern throughout.
Yeah, why did the slaves get less?
Yep.
I think it's because they're seen as less capable and thus less culpable.
That's possible. It's also possible that they're seen as acting on behalf of their masters, and therefore they're not really responsible for their action, because their master could have punished them if they hadn't done it. But if you haven't, we have no proof the master did anything, so we can't punish him. So that would be I don't know. I mean, but it is a fairly standard pattern of.
It's always true. I noticed it was like
half. Yeah, I think I don't know. I don't swear that's always true, but it certainly seems to be the typical pattern is that a slave gets half the number of lashes that a free man would get for the same crime. Which it would just strike me as interesting. Let's see, other things. One point which had occurred to me, which he doesn't discuss, but which I had wondered about, is that on the face of it, the punishment for unlawful intercourse you would think would never get applied, because it requires four witnesses to the same act of unlawful witness. So, you know, unless you're having sex in public, how is that ever going to happen? And it's even more because if one of those, if something is wrong with the accusation, if one of the witnesses turns out not to be a Muslim or to be underage, the others now get punished for false accusations. So it sounds like it would never happen. You know, but wait a minute, there's one counterexample, because the pregnancy of an unmarried woman is also taken as evidence. But then you notice that it's supposed to only apply, at least again according to Forte, which is the only source I've got for this, to somebody who has previously had lawful marital intercourse. Well, normally your unmarried woman is going to be, in theory, a virgin. At least if she hasn't been married, she hasn't had lawful, or been a concubine, she's never had lawful intercourse with anybody. Therefore, it looks as though she can't be guilty of the hot offense either, even though her pregnancy is proof that she's had intercourse with somebody. Now, how whether it really gets applied that way, I just don't know, but it struck me as an interesting point. Now, you could imagine the case, you know, the woman could be, she could be a widow, she could be an ex-concubine, she could be somebody who had had lawful intercourse in the past, and then she's in real trouble when she gets pregnant. But
I guess I thought it was the law of
except for the fact that men don't get pregnant, and therefore you wouldn't have the... Given the normal evidence is four witnesses. I believe, though I am not certain, that the Quranic origin of this is actually an accusation against one of Muhammad's wives. Aisha.
Yeah.
That's right. So, if the accusation was against her, then it was the case of a woman. And, of course, the sort of skeptical interpretation of this is that the reason Muhammad had an interpretation which required such severe levels of proof was he either didn't believe or didn't want to believe his wife was, in fact, guilty of that. Yeah.
It seemed like that attitude or idea of allowing people to become accepted for punishment seems
to be
accepted or find a way to
have more
of them.
Yes.
There's a thing about encouraging magistrates to encourage accused.
Yes.
They can find that they take care of the issue.
Yes. 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 There's a bunch of that.
Maybe you try to get elicit as many professions as you can as a DA.
Yes, no, but this seems to be the opposite. There are at least some cases in which if you don't have the witnesses, the confession of the party can do it, but then the party can recant that confession up to the point where he's punished.
Even after a conviction, when you have the four witnesses, they have to throw the first stone.
Yes.
Say this, but I took it to mean that if they were there and they were in a forgiving mood and just didn't throw the stone instead.
He doesn't get stoned, yeah. Note, by the way, that the stoning part, again, according to Forte, is not Quranic. It's the practice of the early caliphs, therefore believed to be what Muhammad was in favor of, but the actual charge is not there. Now, the other thing, of course, is that men are entitled to have concubines. Just what the rules are on concubines, I don't know, but it does mean that a man who can afford a mistress, as it were, can have her in a perfectly legal fashion, aside from the possible risk of offending his wife. Or wives.
Is the concubine different than the second?
Yes.
The fourth wife?
Yes, yes, yes. The wives, there's a limit of four. There is no limit, as far as I know, in the law on the number of concubines. And exactly where the definition is, where what the differences are in detail, I just don't know. I sort of think that a slave can be a concubine and can't be a wife, but I won't swear that that's right. And there are presumably some other differences that I don't know enough about, but presumably the legal rights of the two are not going to be the same. But of course, in practice, as in any real society, you're also limited by what your first wife will put up with. That is it. And how limiting that is going to depend on her and you and so forth. And you get all of these stories. I think I gave the story about the woman threatening to force her husband to divorce her before, and there's another sort of neat story in which a judge marries, I think, his cousin or something who's wealthy but not all that attractive, and he then uses her money to marry other wives he likes better, and every time he does it, his wife finds out about it, his first wife finds out about it and gets mad at him and forces him to divorce her, and then finally he has a trick by which he manages to persuade her that he hasn't really married somebody he's really married to, and that's what the story is about. It's a neat trick. I won't go through it. It's too long a story, but it's a good story. Though not one that inclined you to trust that particular judge's future honesty. And as a matter of fact, along those lines, there are a bunch of stories associated with Harun al-Rashid, who has this very clever judge. And the cleverness is illustrated by all sorts of cases where Rashid wants to do something that's clearly in violation of the law, and the judge figures out some elaborate detour by which he can do it, theoretically, without violating the law. And there are other stories where it's not so much a matter of an actual case as somebody says, well, how would you do this? And again, so some of the legal scholarship becomes almost a game, in a sense, although other parts of it are obviously taken very seriously. All right. Other points, comments, questions? In terms of sort of the general framework, you've got Muhammad himself for a few years. You then have the four well-guided caliphs, followed by a civil war, which ends up with Muawiyah as caliph, and his descendants are then the Umayyad dynasty, which lasts about 100 years, and is then displaced by the Abbasid dynasty, which lasts quite a lot longer. Under the Abbasid caliphate, in theory, the law is independent of the state. However, the judge who is actually applying that law is appointed by the caliph or by the caliph's authorities. And it's true that the Qadi is supposed to decide according to religious law, but it's also true that the actual enforcement is in the hands of the state. And this gets me to probably my very favorite medieval Islamic law and econ story, which is that the poet Ibn Harma performed before the Prince of the Muslims. And so delighted was the caliph with his performance that he said, have I told you the story yet? No. I tell these stories, I want to make sure. Anyway, so delighted was he with the performance that he said, name your reward. And Ibn Harma said, the reward I wish for the Prince of the Muslims is that he should send instructions to his officials in the city of Medina, commanding that when I am found dead drunk upon the pavement and brought in by the city guard, I be let off from the punishment prescribed for that offense. And the caliph answered, that is God's law, not mine. I cannot change it. Name another reward. There is nothing else I desire from the Prince of the Muslims. And so the caliph thought a little, and he then sent instructions to his officials in the city of Medina that if anyone found the poet Ibn Harma dead, drunk upon the pavement, and brought him in for punishment, Ibn Harma should receive 80 strokes of the lash, as the law commands, but whoever brought him in should receive 100. And ever after, when anyone saw the poet drunk upon the pavement, he would turn to his companion and say, 100 for 80 is a bad bargain, and pass on. So isn't that a wonderful story? Because it partly demonstrates this whole incentive to enforce issue, that the caliph can't repeal the law setting a punishment of drunkenness, because that's hard, that's a Quranic law and under his control, but he can make it in nobody's interest ever enforce that law in this particular case by putting in his, I guess, administrative regulations, essentially, it's obviously not hard, this additional rule about the punishment for bringing him in harmony in for punishment. But it also suggests the degree to which the secular, more the caliph isn't exactly a secular authority, but at least the political authority could maneuver around the fixed points of the law in order to get the results that he wanted. The caliphate had its own police enforcement. It had its own administrative regulations, which would cover things for which either the Quran or indeed all of Sharia, because it's outside of Sharia, didn't have punishments. Where the had enforcement requires for most things two eyewitnesses who are free adult Muslims, four for the specific case of unlawful intercourse, and where you didn't have those two, the next step was to switch from Hod to other, or switch out of Sharia entirely to go to other courts. And there was a Mutasib, who was the inspector of the marketplace for enforcing rules about things in the marketplace. There is a Mazalim, which is a special court to deal with complaints against office holders, and that reminds me of H.L. Mencken's discussion of this whole issue. If you haven't read Mencken, you should. He's a lot of fun. He was a roughly early to mid-20th century journalist, essayist, writer, cynic, who was very good, that he writes very well. He's very funny. But somewhere he's discussing the question of how you can keep government officials from misconduct. And he says, well, the Prussians, he didn't know about Islamic law, but the Prussians had a solution to this problem. The Prussians had a special set of courts for the purpose of punishing official misconduct. And he says that worked in Prussia, because of course a Prussian judge took it for granted that anybody brought in front of him was guilty, whether he was an official or not, and therefore the officials got punished. But he says that would never work in America, because in America the judge would be a member of the same gang of bandits as the erring official, and would therefore always let him out. So we need a uniquely American solution to this problem, Mencken says. And since we are an individualist culture, clearly the American solution is that if a government official wrongs you, you are yourself entitled to give him suitable punishment, and it is then up to the official or his heirs to sue you on the claim that the punishment that you imposed on him was more severe than his misdeeds warranted. And that was sort of an entertaining suggestion. You know, you throw him out of a third-story window, and you are then sued on the ground you should have only thrown him out of a first-story window. But apparently Islam, you have the same pattern, and again, how well it works is going to depend a lot on whether the particular state is one in which the people at the top want erring officials to be punished or not. But in any case, the mausoleum also over time took jurisdiction over a variety of other things, transferring in effect from Sharia courts to that. And again, the sovereign can pass administrative regulations. And you can at least argue that because Sharia gets frozen in about the 10th century, that meant that as new issues came up, they ended up getting dealt with outside of Sharia by the other parts of the system. All right, let me again take a brief break and see whether in all of this stuff you had points that had occurred to you or comments you wanted to make. All right, so a little bit about the Islamic State. And the first question is, why should you pay any attention to the state anyway? Why is it in any sense legitimate? And the Shia view initially is that Ali and his descendants had received from God divine authority, basically. And that therefore, while that sequence went on, the gates of interpretation could not close because the current imam could himself give us new divinely inspired rules. But of course that shut down quite a long time ago. And in substance, I gather that Shia legal doctrine is not very different from Sunni legal doctrine, though I know less about it. The Sunni view basically was that the actual succession of the caliphs was the legitimate succession of the caliphs, that the Umayyads were legitimately the successors of the Prophet, even though they got that way by winning a civil war, that the Abbasids were legitimately the successors of the Prophet after they beat the Umayyads, except that presumably the Western Umayyads, the people who continued to follow the Umayyad Caliphate in Spain and some of North Africa after the Abbasids won and the rest of the Islamic world held, that they were the legitimate the successors of the Prophet and that the Abbasids were fakes. And what happens, in a sense, part of the theory, as far as I can tell, there are sort of two underlying theories by which you eventually square political realism with religious implications. One of them is that God's running the world, so Muawiyah wouldn't have been allowed to win the civil war, as it were, unless he was the right guy. And the other, I think, is that even if the ruler is a bad ruler, being disobedient to him is going to do more harm than good, essentially. So the ruler ought to be a good ruler, but if he isn't, you're still supposed to be obedient to him. And obviously, this isn't like everybody said the same thing, but these were doctrines that came to dominate. And in theory, the succession mechanism to the caliphate seems to be something like the ascent of the Muslim people to this person being the next caliph. And what does that mean? Well, maybe it means all of the prominent people who are held to represent everybody else ascend to it. But in practice, what happens is that the caliph names his successor in his will or sets up some body of people to choose his successor, and the people who are theoretically electors are expected to go along or else. And so you ended up with a system which was hereditary but was not primogeniture. Right? Primogeniture means the oldest son follows. And in the Umayyad and the Abbasid system, as far as I can tell, there was never a rule that it was always the oldest son. It was more or less the son who the father preferred as his heir. And there were Islamic sects which disagreed with this position, which held that you should not be obedient to somebody you'd gotten it illegitimately, or in the Shia case, who wasn't the divinely chosen ruler for a while. That was their position. There was a third split called the Kharijites, who eventually lost out. I'm not sure if there are any of them left now or not. And part of the dispute there was from among what body do you choose the caliph? And that the Orthodox Sunni position is that it can be any member of the Quraysh, any member of the Prophet's tribe, so any descendant basically of the Prophet and his distant relatives. Whereas the view of the Shia initially was that it was basically in Ali's line, so that was narrower, and the view of the Kharijites was, I believe, it could be any Muslim. For some reason, the Kharijite position was popular in North Africa, where there weren't a whole lot of Arabs initially. Therefore, very few Quraysh. And in theory, you weren't supposed to be obedient in sin, but in practice you were. That is, you were supposed to be obedient to the ruler. A ruler who wasn't legitimate or who wasn't himself a religious scholar was supposed to take the advice of the religious scholars in the community, but in practice what's pretty clearly happening over the centuries is a drift towards the caliph really being an emperor, really being a secular authority who ignores the religious authorities when he feels like it, and once in a while you get some oddball caliph who really believes in the stuff and lives an ascetic life and is thought very highly of, and may or may not do a good job of running Islam. You're not quite sure about that, but mostly they aren't. And eventually, as the Abbasid caliphate sort of stumbles towards its end, you end up with the caliphs as really figureheads, and some prince or sultan or basically military leader is the person who's really running things. Which incidentally parallels, as some of you may know, the Japanese pattern, where back, about 1000 AD or a little after that, you end up, you had had in the early Japanese period, you had an emperor who apparently was really running things. You then have a period of civil violence, which ends up with a shogun. And the shogun, I think, theoretically is in some sense a servant of the emperor, but you really end up that the shogun is the ruler of Japan, and the emperor has a court off somewhere where he has poets and literary stuff, and where everybody, including the shogun, you know, tells him how wonderful he is and how he's really in charge of things, but he doesn't have any real power. And you may know how that story ended, because it's sort of an extraordinary historical. In the late 19th century, the Japanese, in their inimitable style, decided they needed a modernist revolution, and so they did their modernist revolution by putting the emperor back in power. The so-called Meiji Restoration, about 1870, 1880, somewhere around there, consisted of eliminating the shogunate, which had been the real rulers of Japan by that time for about 700 or 800 years, and treating the emperor, who had been sitting off there being a figurehead for 700 or 800 years, as now the power. So that if you read about stuff during World War II and all of the authority of the emperor and such, that was in effect a situation where it had existed for less than 100 years at that time. It was a new modernist revision. But anyway, that's a digression, but I think sort of mildly interesting one. So, let me keep going for a moment. Other things. All right, again, let me stop just for a minute to let you people cut in, because it's hard to cut in when I'm talking too fast, which I'm usually doing. Anybody? Nobody? All right, so crimes you've now read all about, and the basic categories are the Quranic crimes, the hot offenses, which all have specified punishments. And as I say, in at least one case, the punishment specified isn't actually in the Quran, although the crime is. Then there are the discretionary offenses, which I think are still counted as part of Sharia, but they are at the judge's discretion and presumably are supposed to be based on hadith and things interpreted from hadith. Then there is the system which involves retaliation and blood money by kinsmen. Then there is a system entirely outside of Sharia, which is the offenses against public policy, where you've got administrative punishments. And and then there are the acts which are corrected by personal penance rather than by an actual punishment. I was actually thinking there's a case which I discuss in my other seminar, a modern case, a modern American university case, which is a personal penance case, which is interesting because it raises precisely the issue of whether it's voluntary or not. This was at Cornell University some years ago. Some freshmen, male freshmen, were circulating among their friends a list of misogynist jokes, of jokes hostile to women. And somehow this got to somebody who disapproved, and it ended up being very widely circulated. years. And there was this big uproar over these terrible jokes that were beset by email. And the question arose of whether this was in violation of any university rules or whether the university, as a believer in free speech, ought to say, well, we may disapprove of this, but people are free to make misogynist jokes if they like. And eventually there was an announcement by the university administration that these students had not violated any rules and therefore would not be punished, but that the students had voluntarily agreed to do so many hours of community service in things basically serving women who were being harassed, to publicly apologize, a list of stuff. And this raised a very obvious question to any sort of skeptical observer as to how voluntary this voluntary stuff was. And the obvious suspicion was the university was trying to have its cake and eat it too, that it was simultaneously saying, we are in favor of free speech, so we won't punish these people, and then punishing them because if you're a freshman and the administrators say, you know, it would really be a very good thing if you did A, B, and C, it may occur to you that your next 3 years may be pretty unpleasant if you don't do A, B, and C. And the sequel to this, which is why God gets into my book Future Imperfect, is, which is in part, among many other things about what happens when you've got things like the internet, is that a email went out to essentially everybody in the Cornell community, many thousands of people, which purported to be from the administrator who had announced this result, and which was gloating over the fact that we have managed to punish the three little pigs while still pretending to maintain our belief in free speech, and asked for responses from the people who it went out to. And some of those people responded, and then the people who had sent out the email, who were very clearly not the administrator in question, sent out a second email saying, we sent out this fake email pretending to be the administrator, and here are responses we got from people agreeing with that position. So you can see that Cornell was really engaged in fraud. Now, of course, they were also engaged in fraud because they were selecting the responses. For all we know, they got 8 responses saying, yeah, yeah, links to the three little pigs, and 300 responses saying, that's terrible. You shouldn't punish people for free speech. We don't know that. All we know is what they selected. But it made an interesting case of sort of the use of modern technology for what's a sort of a form of information warfare, as it were, that the people who believed, the people presumably at Cornell, who believed that Cornell was engaged in hypocrisy, were able to campaign for their side via this fraudulent sort of spam email. But anyway, but it did occur to me just now that was another case where you have a punishment which in theory, in our society, is seen as voluntary penance done by people confessing their evil deeds, and which is ambiguous to what extent it's really voluntary, to what extent it really isn't. If you want more details, my book Future Imperfect is up on the web, link to my website, and you can read about the terrible case of the three little pigs. Alright, other things, as I say, we've already discussed the hot offense of unlawful intercourse. In general, the rule seems to be that Muslims can only be convicted on the evidence of Muslim witnesses, that non-Muslims can be convicted on the evidence of non-Muslim witnesses. And there's a general, sort of one of the, in a sense, intriguing features of this whole structure of law is that it's intended to apply to Muslims and to non-Muslims, but there's none of this nonsense about everybody is equal or you know, the church, the state is neutral in matters of religion or whatever. Of course, the non-Muslims are second-class citizens, but they're second-class citizens who are still entitled to suitable protection of the law and so forth. And the false accusation, I think, only against a Muslim is a crime, if I've got it right. But then another thing which is interesting, given what I've discussed before about oaths, is this whole question of fraternity. That in English common law, a husband can't challenge the paternity of his wife's children as long as they were conceived when they were cohabiting. That's so-called Lord Mansfield's rule, which is breaking down now that we have paternity tests, but made a lot of sense for a couple hundred years. In the Islamic context, the accusation by a husband of his wife's adultery or the related accusation that the child isn't his, in order for the husband to charge it without being punished if he can't prove it, he has to swear a fivefold oath. And basically calling down on himself divine punishment if he's saying it isn't true. I don't know whether he's swearing that the woman, that his wife has been unfaithful, or only that he believes she has been, because it seemed a little bit unfair to condemn him to hell or whatever if he just made a mistake. Yeah. I think he says one oath four times, and then a different one the fifth time, if I remember correctly.
The fifth one is calling the curse down.
Yeah, I think that's right. He's swearing four times that she did it, and once asking that he be punished if what he's saying isn't true. But again, I don't know if it's true or believed to be true. I don't know that definition. However, at that point, the wife gets to swear the same fivefold oath and rebut. So that's a case where, and you're going to see this again in a different context, where under some circumstances, people can either get into or out of a case, as it were, by swearing this right oath, which again shows up also in Jewish law. Whether it was borrowed from that, I don't know. But basically, if the husband makes the accusation but isn't willing to swear the fourfold oath, and can't prove that she's guilty, then he gets a hard punishment for false accusation. If the husband swears his oath and the wife refuses to swear hers, then she is presumed to be guilty and is punished for her guilt. And this is the only way in which you can contest paternity. For wine drinking, one of the interesting minor details is that three of the four schools have 80 lashes, 40 lashes, and one of the four schools has 40 lashes, 20 lashes.
Yep. I'm one fan of this about the wine drinking. One of the schools said that only wine was illegal.
Yes. The exact interpretation is varied among the schools, and the most extreme permissive one that I actually read about this, oddly enough, in a book on the history of coffee, because when coffee is first coming into Islam, which is about 1400 AD or so, the controversy arises as to whether it's an intoxicating beverage.
Does coffee count as wine?
That was the question, exactly. Because it's a drug that affects your mind. So it's not obvious what does or doesn't count. And it clearly, in Islamic law, it's not limited to wine. But just where the lines are drawn depends. And at least according to the most permissive source, at least according to the book I read on this, what was forbidden was either drinking literally wine, fermented grapes, or getting so drunk that you could not tell a man from a woman or the earth from the sky. And I think this was supposed to be popular among the Ottoman Turks, as I remember this interpretation of the law. Whereas at the other extreme, the position is that it is forbidden to drink any amount of something which in large enough amounts would make you intoxicated. So that's their version of the Delaney Amendment. You know what the Delaney Amendment is? That's the one which says basically that you can't have an ingredient in food that causes cancer, even if what that means is that very large quantities of it cause cancer, you can't have it in even very small quantities. That's my memory, at least, of the Delaney Amendment to the Pure Food and Drug Act. Yeah, American law. Right. Yeah, it's sort of crazy because there are all sorts of things which are lethal. I mean, arsenic is nutritionist. You know, arsenic is a trace mineral which you're supposed to get some of. Large amounts of it have bad effects on you.
Well, I read a story the other day where some scientists had published an article saying that grilled foods, charcoal food,
right.
That's
right. Yeah, sure. So obviously, that's right. That's right. If you take it literally, so. But one doesn't always. Just like the medieval Muslims, we don't always enforce the letter of our law. Probably a good thing, too. And for drinking, basically, you need two witnesses, and it can either be to the drinking itself, the wine on your breath, or the fact you were observed to be drunk. And theft is one that's gotten a lot of attention because of the idea that there's this barbaric penalty of cutting somebody's hand off. And one of the things that I find sort of hard to tell when reading about these things is whether what was really going on was that the authorities enforcing it qualified the rule so much it was almost never applied, or whether what's really going on is that the modern people defending the rule want to see it as being so qualified that it's never applied. But again, you're going to see that again in the Jewish law, because there's this rule that basically being rude to your parents is a capital offense. And you then get, I think, Maimonides saying that after giving his whole list of special conditions that have to be met, that therefore it's never going to be applied. Well, why would God put into the Bible a rule that's ever going to be applied? I think that has some excuse for God putting into the Bible a rule that will never be applied. So that pattern you get. But in the case of the hot offense of theft, I think you have to be an adult. I think that stealing food never counts as theft because the presumption is that you were hungry. And I think that stealing something which you believe you had some claim to doesn't count as theft. And I think you're allowed to testify to the fact that you believe you had some claim to it. But I don't remember all the details, but I think my memory is that 40 goes into some detail on all of the qualifications, such as very unlikely the penalty will be imposed. And again, since pretty clearly he, like anybody who wants to argue this is on the whole a pretty sensible legal system, has an incentive to argue the things that people see as barbaric about it aren't really there. Highway robbery, on the other hand, which includes, incidentally, not only real highway robbery, but also housebreaking. That basically coming into a house armed in order to rob people counts as highway robbery and is a very serious offense. Similarly, under 18th century English law, ordinarily theft had to be of at least 40 shillings to be a capital offense, but I believe stealing from a house when the inhabitants of the house were there and could be put in fear by the act, I think, was automatically a capital offense. So you get a somewhat similar distinction in both cases. And this applies whether the victims are Muslims or non-Muslims, and the first time you do it, you lose one hand and one foot, which you would think would make it hard for you to engage in highway robbery again, but you lose the other two next time just in case. And if you kill anybody, you get executed in addition to that. And unlike the penalty for, let us say, killing somebody, this one can't be compounded by blood money. So it's not that if you kill someone under these circumstances, if his heirs say, let him go, you let him go. Whatever his heirs say, you've in effect committed a crime, a hard crime, a crime against God, and you'll get punished. All right, we can go on. Next time, about, you know, keep